There we go. Okay. So this is from the Notebooks of Dr. Brain. This is a book that the sell line to my publisher was, it's a self-help book for superheroes. So on the surface, that's what it is, but it's obviously it's a novel, and like self-help books, it takes the story, it takes several case studies of people and explores them through to a remarkable climax. In this particular case, in this fictional universe, it is the story of the Fantastic Order of Justice, the world's mightiest super team. The problem is that by 1991, they had won the most important battle in superhero history, the Götterdämmerung, the Twilight of the Gods, the battle against all supervillains, and as a result, they have nothing left to do. I mean, what do you do when you've defeated all of the enemies? And the problem is that the Fantastic Order of Justice, or the Fooge as it's called, operates at the whim of the American federal government and receives massive operating grants, so they have to justify their existence. And as a result of this, many of their members, not having an external enemy to fight, have fallen into infighting, and a variety of their weird psychological hang-ups have come out, and there have been tell-all books and scandals, and some people have been kicked out. It's a terrible thing. Six members in particular are the worst, most contentious members of the group, and they have been ordered by the board of directors of the Fooge to go into group counseling. And if they don't, they're going to be fired, they'll lose their benefits, they'll lose their pensions, so they really don't have a choice, and they hate being in therapy. So they go to see this world's answer to Dr. Phil, or to Dr. Ruth, who is Dr. Janice Brain Silverman. The Janice is just a coincidence, by the way. And so anyway, she's known as Dr. Brain, so she's therapist to the superhero stars. Now, in this world, there is one, the mightiest hero who created the Fooge. He was the recruiter, the organizer, named Hawk King. He's an Egyptian god, and then, very strangely, as we discovered at the very beginning of the book, he's died. This shouldn't be able to happen to a god. It's in the job description. And so one of the members of the team is convinced, well, this cannot be natural causes. This has to be murder most foul. So as a result, he decides to lead an investigation. And if he's correct that this was murder, that means, well, if you can murder the mightiest superhero alive, then obviously everybody's in trouble. Now, what's the book really about? Well, the book is, yes, it's a polemic against the worst excesses of psychotherapy and self-help books, but it is largely about the Bush administration. So many of the characters in it you will recognize if you choose to read the novel. So anyway, I'm going to read you a section in which Dr. Brain has been seeing her patients in her therapy room. She's been challenged by one of her patients, who she doesn't like to call them patients. She calls them sanity supplicants. Okay. She has decided that she'll go out into the field and she's going to visit him on his turf, because he said that she didn't have the guts to do that. So his name is Philip Kareem Edgerton, or he's known as the X-Man, and he lives in the so-called ghetto called Langston Douglas. So she decides that she's going to go out there, and she really does not fit in. So while she goes there and talks with him, he unloads on her. So I'm going to read you that section. And it's all from her point of view. We were only a block away from a subway entrance when Kareem stopped with his arm out holding me back. He pointed along both sides of the street toward the boarded up faces of half a dozen businesses, one after the other. Ruby's Ribs, Deacon's Gumbo, Junior's Jerk Palace and Ting, Down Home Chicken, Bama Ass Chicken, and Get Your Chicken. Finally, he pointed to the far end of the street and the bustling business enjoyed by the Squirrel Burger franchise enthroned there. Because of my access to the files of the Fooge, I wasn't surprised that the X-Man would single out this particular burger business. Indeed, the battle between the young Philip Kareem Edgerton and the Squirrel Burger Corporation had nearly prevented Kareem's membership in the Fooge and had ensured a hatred between Kareem and the ultimate master of Squirrel Burger, a division of Piltdown Edible Products International, Festus Piltdown III, a.k.a. the Flying Squirrel. In 1986, when Kareem was still operating under the name of Mac Rude, he and several other members-to-be of his black crime-fighting organization, the League of Angry Black Men, went to war with every Squirrel Burger outlet in Langston Douglas. Arnold Drummond launched dozens of frivolous lawsuits against franchise owners. The Dark Fantastic used his shadow powers to make every restaurant so dark that the kitchens were unusable. And Kareem deployed his rudimentary logogenic ability to manifest 3D graffiti above Squirrel Burger restaurants declaring such phrases as, "Squirrel Burger is destroying black business." When that campaign had minimal effect, Kareem changed his slogans to urge ghetto residents to stick it to the squirrel, buy black. That campaign's failure prompted Kareem to develop his power further, creating mobile word swarms and tags that actually followed squirrel customers after they left the restaurants. Diners found themselves returning to home, school, and work with 3D phrases such as, "I lick the squirrel's nuts," and "I drink milk nutshakes orbiting their heads." Squirrel Burger business plummeted, and local restaurateurs rejoiced. But eventually, Squirrel Burger Corporation regrouped with its franchise owners by offering free burgers, squirrely fries, and chocolate bushy tails. And exhausted and overstretched, Kareem and his comrades couldn't maintain their crusade and with its homophobic slogans against the sheer numbers of new squirrel diners. Eventually, they surrendered completely. "Makes me sick," said Kareem, glaring at the giant, scowling squirrel mascot as if he were Dante in the pit staring up at the beast, and then at the people waddling in and out of the fast food outlet. "But it takes a nation of millions to keep us fat and stupid, and that nation happens to be us." Now, don't you think people should have the free choice to eat where they want, Kareem? Do you think you should have the authority to tell everyone what to do, how to eat, what to think, to say nothing of depriving local people of jobs? "Shit, Doc, are you kidding? Don't get me started on jobs. Minimum wage jobs. No benefits, swing shifts. How about down here in Stunglass we get some of that high-tech investment from the dimensional research contracts they do up there in the Tachyon Tower, and all the spin-off jobs that go with that? Now that'd be some jobs. Can you even see what's in front of your eyes? Look across the street. Fools weighing 350 pounds ordering a mega meal kilo burger, a gross of squirrely fries, and a half-and-half shake thickened with Crisco? You see that man right there? That one. He can barely walk, but he's walrusing around like an NBA star in his Adidas sneakers and Nike track pants. I mean, they must be knockoffs, because Nike doesn't make size infinity. But this mad-ass madness of trying to look athletic when you're lethally stuffing yourself with the filthiest foods on the planet, diabetes, heart attacks, used to be poor people starved to death, Doc. Now we overeat to death, killing us off with low-quality, high-fat food, obesing us all into the grave. And Squirrel Burger, it's just a name, Doc. That shit shack serves actual squirrels." Now, Kareem, we both know that's not true, isn't it? You're telling me that the FDA has approved the sale of wild rodent meat to the general public? You think the multi-billion-dollar Piltdown Group doesn't get whatever it wants, whenever it wants? The FDA is a $3.42 hole, Doc. Wake up! And the squirrels aren't wild. Piltdown's got huge factory farms down in Alabama, Kentucky, Arkansas. Everywhere Piltdown pulled out his high-tech manufacturing and moved it to Mexico or New Atlantis. Got all those downsized crackers working his squirrel ranches. Billions of squirrels in teeny-tiny cages, force-fed ground-up rats that were force-fed ground-up roaches that were fed ground-up brains of all the mentally retarded prisoners that they execute down in Dixieland. You ever hear of the China syndrome? A nuclear reactor burning all the way down to China? Well, this is Piltdown syndrome, burning us all down to nothing, to nothing. He threw up his arms, aiming his tirade like a wrecking ball at all the empty buildings. "But people are dumb, deaf, dumb, and blind. You can scream the truth in letters 10 miles tall, and still, the only thing they'll notice is nothing. The whole reason Brother Larry opened the restaurant, the Dark Star, was so people have something tasty and healthy to eat after Squirrel Burger drove everybody else out of business. You know, you can buy and get stoned from a whole bag of crack in this neighborhood easier and cheaper you can buy a goddamn salad. But if it weren't for the League and a few others, Larry wouldn't even be able to keep his doors open." Kareem's rant veered wildly, even into how the League had operated its own, quote, social programs to counter white influence, including free breakfast for shorties, Africa medallions for homies, and free fades, flat tops, and Afro picks for soul brothers, the last of which was undermined by something Kareem called the Jerry Curl plague, which left what he claimed was, quote, jerry bags and activator empties lying in the gutters of the MLK Boulevard of Dreams Deferred. Suddenly, Kareem turned on me with accusation burning in his eyes like lit candles. "I sure hope you aren't planning to turn this conversation or any of our sessions into one of your books, Doc." "Well, Kareem, I'm sure if you actually were to read any of my..." "I checked out all your stuff after we got sentenced to your therapy. All of it. I pity the poor mopes you psycho-catalyzed. I read what those suckers said, although I had to read between the lines to deduce what you cut out since the way you edited everything was so self-serving. And then I read your diagnoses and speculations and bizarre psycho-superstitious slop. damn, the least insightful, most outrageous conclusions, like you couldn't see cute on a puppy. Well, be that as it may, Corinne, I mean, in the dictionary next to the definition of unreliable narrator, there's got to be a picture of your degree. I hate to think how you'd be framing anything I'd ever said. You take one little word out of what people say, then psychopontificate the hell out of it until you got the readers thinking the afflicted are the afflictors and the afflictors are the afflicted. No different than the Fooge helping to destroy New Atlantis while protecting the people bringing drugs into our neighborhoods. It was time to cut through the Gordian knot of Kareem's white persecution complex. If everything you're saying is true, Kareem, why did you even join the Fooge? Why not remain in Sunglass full-time fighting alongside your league? What, remain ghetto-wise, cut off from the reach that only the Fooge has, and unable to affect change past my own neighborhood, prevented from joining a wider cause? Then you'd accuse me of... Didn't the League expel you? He stopped, his jaw half open. He closed it, then opened it again, only long enough to say, no, no. Andre said earlier that you weren't welcome at the Dark Star restaurant. You didn't rebut him. What did he mean? Look! He yelled, we're in serious danger, Doc. Can you get that through your head? Omnipotent man resigned. Hawk King's dead by causes unknown. The Fooge is a goddamn disaster. This morning at the funeral, the appearance of the Netcheru, that was a warning to all of us, a harbinger that if we don't... The what? The Netcheru? The Netcheru, Doc. Don't you know anything? The so-called Egyptian gods who took Hawk King's sarcophagus away. They haven't appeared on Earth in 5,000 or 6,000 years. You think they don't want his killer caught? What do you think they'll do if we don't avenge his death? Are you saying that these gods are as... are inferior as detectives to you? I'm saying that, look, even if they don't, I don't know, whatever. What do you think's going to happen if we don't bring his killer to justice? Who's next? And how many after that? Because if you can kill someone of Hawking's power, then nobody's safe. How can you not see that? All right, Kareem. All right, what? You believe that Gil Gamoid and the N-Kid and or the Destroyer could be behind this alleged crime, correct? Yes, for the ninth time. Then let's go ask them. What are you talking about? Thanks to you jailing me in therapy, my investigation's barely started, and a detective doesn't tip his hand to a suspect until he's... I'm worried that you're manifesting a vast, disabling, paranoid fantasy, Kareem, and that's what's truly jailing you. I'll go to Asteroid Z tomorrow and interview them myself, and if you won't, so we can rule out Gil Gamoid and N-Kid as suspects. You do that, and you're going to destroy the one element of surprise and blow the only chance I've got with them. So I'm going to the asteroid, Kareem, to speak with your triumvirate of terror myself, unless you want to go with me to rule them out. He flailed his arms, yelled at me, explained his case a dozen times, pleaded with me not to go. I wouldn't budge. Finally, after haranguing me for a full 10 minutes, he fell silent, his shoulders drooping while his gaze scoured the weeds creeping out of the cracks in the concrete. He shook his head, chewed his lip. When? First space elevator up at 5 a.m., if memory serves. God damn, fine, 5 a.m., lift to the kingdom of the damned. As always, I asked at the end of every session for each sanity supplicant to summarize in 10 words or less their sense of ennui in this age of superhero contraction. I asked, how will you face knowing that you will never exceed or even equal the accomplishments of your predecessors? He responded, catching this super assassin is all the glory that I need. Now, whether I chose to combat the racialized neurosis of the X-Men and his comrades, or the end-of-epoch ennui of the mainstream Foodsters, an ascent to the orbital penitentiary where the world's worst supercriminals in history were entombed alive, seemed at that moment to be the only path toward mental clarity. The death of Hawking had so damaged the already fragile psyches of my group that unless they engaged in a mythopoeic descent to an underworld, my sanity supplicants would find themselves lost in the sewers of self-delusion until finally drowning in the downspouts of depression. Perhaps it would take the horror of staring into the face of the villain who had murdered so many heroes, or into the faces of the two founding Foodsters who went mad and came close to murdering them all, for my team to pull back from the brink of self-destruction and be reborn from the psychotherapeutic womb of self-redemption. Thanks. So I will say that my greatest fear in writing this particular book was that I had to come up with the worst metaphors possible to convincingly write the voice of the author, And I was really worried, what if people think this is how I actually write? So fortunately, most people got the joke. So it was actually kind of fun after a while to write the world's worst possible metaphors. So at any rate,
do you want to...
Do
you have any questions?
Yes, absolutely. Sure. So let me just grab my tea. And so please, some questions of any sort? Tom.
Well, I'll start off. This seems like a very verbal book to me. You know, it's part of the fun of it is actually reading parts of it out loud for oneself, right?
Yes.
So I'm wondering, as a writer, do you do that as you write? Do you speak these parts of most of the book to yourself out loud?
Yes, which is a good reason to work at home, so as to avoid being carted off somewhere. As I was mentioning to one of your students before the session started, I recommend for everybody who wants to write prose that you should write plays or sketch comedy or something else that requires your work to be read out loud. Because that's the way you're going to know for sure that your work, your dialogue is true, it's believable, that it's funny, to use the cliche, which we should avoid, that it's snap, crackles, and pops. Because that is important. People should read your dialogue and want to read it out loud. And regardless of how sad your book ultimately is, you should be able to make people laugh out loud while they're reading your book. And that's how honest the language should be. And certainly when I edit, I do need to read everything out loud just to make sure that the rhythm of sentences is correct and so forth. So there are many, I don't know how many, have any written for sketch comedy or the stage? What are you waiting for? Come on! There are several comedy groups in town, and I would encourage you just to go out to some shows. Ask if they have workshops, ask if you can sit in and write for them, because I learned more about writing concisely and writing humor, which was worked well in prose, through sketch comedy than in any creative writing experience I ever had. With no disrespect to your obviously excellent work, I just didn't benefit from your instruction myself, so I didn't have it. So, so any more questions in this room? Yes?
Your work really depends on illusions, getting the length.
Thank you.
And I'm wondering how you test that out. If you have as many readers, if you respond to readers saying,
yes,
you know what, I didn't get this.
Right.
Or how you judge that.
Yeah, well, thank you for that. And you said you had a very nice way of saying appalling self-indulgence. Lots of allusions. The thing is that I feel, you know, and I don't know if you feel the same way, Tom, but I mean, if you're not writing to please your own sensibility first, you're probably going to be really unhappy with your work. And I figure that I'm going to make, you know, 100 allusions, and if any, you know, in a given space, and if this writer reader catches 10 and this one catches 5, well, everybody got something. It's kind of a snack bar. You know, everyone found something they liked. And you know, who knows? I mean, every once in a while, I mean, I get letters from across North America and occasionally further, and, you know, people will say, oh, I like this, and that's always really pleasant when somebody says, oh, I caught this reference. And but, I mean, I don't do it to be pretentious. I just put it in because I really like it, you know. And so, yeah, I gave up a long time ago, you know, the idea that anybody was going to catch them all, or that there'd be an annotated edition of the books or anything like that. So if I were paid to do it, I would do it, but otherwise, no. So thank you. Some more questions.
Another question about...
What I was going to say was, how do you feel about writing science fiction in, you know, a contemporary world where people don't seem as interested in science, let alone science fiction?
Hmm.
How do you see that being reflected in the genre for the years to come?
Well, that's an excellent question. One of the most germane. And I'd like to point out from the start that I believe that science fiction, ideally, is the medium that comments on today's problems and crises metaphorically. And while, you know, there's humor in the book and so forth, it's really a fundamentally very serious and very grim book. Robert J. Sawyer, who's one of Canada's top writers and also its top science fiction writer, actually has given the advice, including to me, that science fiction publishing as such is dying, and the only way to survive as a writer and to thrive is to essentially is to do what Michael Crichton and Margaret Lawrence have done, which is to fake writing mainstream fiction. They write science fiction, but they pretend it's not, and they might even object if somebody said this is science fiction. So you know, as a result, wait, did I get my Margaret's mixed up?
Atwood.
Thank you. You know, I always do that. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, Atwood. Yeah. So there you go. So that's the thing. You know, whether it's The Handmaid's Tale or Oryx and Crake. I haven't read that.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, science fiction. Whether it's looking at, you know, dystopias or whether it's looking at our contemporary society through the options and problems posed by science, it has enormous appeal. The funny thing is that a lot of people say, oh, I would never read science fiction. They've probably already read it. Flowers for Algernon, brilliant book, one of the finest novels I've ever read, and a perfect work of science fiction. People who will watch films and enjoy those, and then they'll turn up their nose at reading a science fiction book. Fantasy isn't science fiction, but loads of people will, for instance, including at the academic level, read Harry Potter and say they wouldn't dream of reading, you know, somebody else. Neil Gaiman, you know. I don't get it. As far as what about the diminishing influence of science, this is a tricky question because obviously science has increasing impact on our lives, and some people argue that there is a fear that people have in this technological society in which people can be destroyed by technology or their lives controlled, that people have returned to this pastoral vision of a peaceful green past, which might in part explain why is something like Lord of the Rings so popular, these films, in a United States that has such a taste for a fundamentalist version of Christianity. Why is it that this completely non-Christian Lord of the Rings is so popular? And I would argue because that world of fantasy presents a world of polar opposites of good and evil, and it's very easy to say these are the bad guys, and it's easy to sign on to the Lord of the Rings prescriptions for your problems, which is kill them all. I mean, it's a very popular work espousing or advocating genocide, and science fiction sometimes does that, but I think it's more likely to look at uncertainty and lack of clarity. And to make a non-literary reference, but just a scripts, some of you in this room may know the new Battlestar Galactica.
Yes.
I'm hoping some of you do. Good, excellent. This is the bravest American television series there's ever been. This is a program that is about the United States against Al-Qaeda and in the occupation of Iraq, except that we never know, are our humans, our good guys, are they the Americans or are they Al-Qaeda? And a show that doesn't let anybody take sides and doesn't let anybody feel self-satisfied, that's the best thing that science fiction can do, I think, you know, is to challenge us on our conceits and to say, in a world where genocide is a real possibility, how do we pull back? And so, I apologize for the length of that answer, but I hope that addresses some of it. So some more questions about technique or publishing or how do you get published or anything like that or whatever? You're really making me feel lousy. Okay, yes. Okay.
One of the things I found when you were reading is your dialogue is very natural, and you were really in character with the superhero and the psychologist were very different. What advice do you give for authors who want to get in character with their characters and make dialogue that sounds like it's coming from the character they're writing?
Well, what I would suggest you do is do what probably almost everybody in this room does, but do it now that you can legitimize it. Mock people. Because the more that you find people who, you know, and you all do it. I mean, you all, you know, you blame the professor said that, and then you go into this voice, or the guy at the back class, he's always putting his hand up, he talks like this. You're already doing it, you know? So all you have to do is figure out a way to write down your imitation. And then the more of these that you do, the more authentic, the more voices you'll collect. And so in this case, like, I just did, you know, two, but there's, you know, a dozen different dialects or voices in this book, ranging from, you know, a German professor to, you know, a Britney Spears clone to, you know, to a guy who's like Conrad Black meets Thurston Howell III. So, you know, there's a big range. In my first book, there were 11 narrators, and each one had a distinctive voice. So I didn't have a chapter title with the character's name in it. You just had to figure out on the basis of the voice. So, and Tom and I went to creative writing class with a fellow who every character he wrote sounded just like him. You probably know what I'm talking about, you know. And unfortunately, he didn't sound like anybody else in the world, so it didn't really work. We went to school with a guy who was a 21-year-old, 200-year-old man from, you know, from England. So I don't know quite how that worked, but you know, just, you know, mock people, and you'll have fun with it. And then it goes from mockery to mimicry, and from mimicry to you know, to really capturing. And I think ultimately, with dialect, if it's mockery in the end, then it failed. If you're demonstrating that you really love how people sound, I've never encountered an accent that I didn't think was really amazing and beautiful and wonderful. And it's just this storehouse of so much personality, you know? So if you can capture that, and you will, you're already doing it out loud, start to write it down, look at how the people who do it well do it, and you know, you'll have a great time with that. Don't use apostrophes, please, when you're dropping sounds and syllables. Just string the letters together. That way it doesn't look like you're chopping up everything with little marks and diacriticals. That'd be my one piece of advice on it. So you were going to ask or make a comment.
Yeah, I was
going to
ask how you first learned about getting published. I mean, like the more in-depth process, like who you, or maybe not who, you know, want to tell us.
No, that's fine.
Yeah. Submit it, and then, like, it goes about like how they contact you.
Sure. Absolutely. Well, and I should point out that Professor Wharton could tell you a lot more about that than I could, because you beat me to the punch by many years and also enjoyed enormous success and acclaim and so forth. So you probably want to speak with Tom afterwards. But what I can say in my case is, how many of you read Writer's Digest magazine? Janice, I mean, come on. Why? All right. So Writer's Digest, you can get it at the Edmonton Public Library, and you might be able to get it here at the university. And it's an amazing magazine. It's got all kinds of advice on certainly everything from the artistic side, but also the business side. And if you want to write purely for the art of it and you don't care about getting published, great. You don't need this magazine. But if you have any intention of other people paying for your work, which is what it means to be a professional writer, then and you getting paid, which means not to be a sucker writer, then I would say this magazine will help you tremendously. In my particular case, one of the most important steps, and I have to give credit to Professor Daphne Reed, who years ago gave me the advice, if you want to write, write. You know, don't put the rest of your life on hold, but like devote yourself to that. You know, do it. Don't worry about getting the fifth or the eighth degree. Write your book, you know. But the thing is, when it comes to getting an agent, which is one of the most important steps, every agent who's working, who isn't a crook, is looking for reasons to turn you down. They're too busy as it is. They don't want to take on somebody else. So what you have to do is find somebody with the least reasons to say no to you. So it involves, for one thing, find a book that you like, that you think is similar to what you're doing, and find out who was the agent there. And then you can approach that agent and say, I'm running some similar stuff. Here's a sample chapter. They say, don't send a sample chapter. Send a query letter. Why would you waste your time? Just send them the sample chapter. If they don't want it, too bad. Okay. You can find folks that way. Beware of crooks. Writer's Digest gives you lots of advice on how to avoid that. There's websites on how you know if you're dealing with a crooked agent. There's a guy that I went to school with here who wrote apparently quite a terrific book on hockey. And a publisher bought it, and of course the publisher has rights for the first printing and blah blah blah. The reason the publisher bought it was because he was just about to release another book on the same topic and he didn't want the competition. So, and I don't even know when, if ever, those rights would elapse, you know, or would lapse, I'm sorry. So, you know, I mean, not everyone's getting ripped off. It's rare, but it can happen, so you really want to protect yourself, and Writer's Digest will help you do that. Know other writers, talk with other people, that's all good. But the best single thing, if you forgot everything else, Writer's Digest, that would be the best thing I could say. So, anybody else?
I just wanted to ask a little bit about your humor, because you talked about the downspout of depression.
Yes, yes.
And how does your humor move from political activism to wild satire?
Yes.
And kind of political nature.
My favorite comics are the comics who've been political. And, in the United States, the dean of political comics was Dick Gregory. You know, a lot of people think it's George Carlin, but Dick Gregory was the guy who really, I'm talking about the 20th century, so, you know, I don't think Mark Twain stood on a stage and started, you know, making jokes and having a cigar and say, hey, who's from Philadelphia? You know, Dick Gregory. And a lot of folks here wouldn't have heard of Dick Gregory, but without Dick Gregory, there would have been no Richard Pryor, who also did a lot of political and social commentary. There wouldn't have been a Chris Rock. So Dick Gregory was an author, a political activist, ran for president. He's most recently known for advocating better health and better diet and so forth, but a remarkable man. And wrote a book called No More Lies, The Myth and Reality of American History, which is long before Howard Zinn did Howard Zinn readers, who?
People's History.
Thank you, People's History of the United States. So, he did that, it was funny, and it was accurate. So that's part of where the humor comes from. And, you know, I give a number of talks, and as you nicely pointed out, I do give speeches and stuff. And if you're going to get people to listen to you and you can't make them laugh, especially the more serious your topic and the more unpleasant your topic, if you can't make them laugh along the way, you know, they're really, unfortunately, they're going to want to stop listening. So I would say to everybody, you know, in your work as a writer, as soon as possible, start to develop your capacity for humor. And, you know, Tom was very impressive and, you know, dashing and so forth. And, you know, he's got his sophisticated books and all that. Tom was a very funny writer in our class. And I remember one of my favorite stories by Tom involved, it was a travel log of a haughty, like, 19th century traveler through the Canadian Rockies. And it's an unreliable narrator who is actually, as he talks about the water and the snow and all, he's really talking about his own diarrhea. You know, it's a diarrhea story. I mean, so, you know, and it was hilarious.
Thanks for bringing that up.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, and I mean, but seriously, it was terrific. And I mean, if I can remember a story that I would have read, you know, 17 years ago, that's a pretty good sign. You know, so, and it was easily one of the top three diarrhea stories I'd ever read. So, you know, but yeah, developing your sense of humor, it's absolutely critical. And my feeling on the subject with humor is that, let's say you go to a party or you're invited to dinner and you're sitting next to somebody and he just spills out for you this horrible life story. It's gripping, you know. But he's talking, you know, his dog died in a murder suicide pact with the cat, and you know, and his wife left him, house burned down, all that, you know. So you're gripped. But you know, the next time you see him, like, you are going to walk across the room to avoid this guy because this is the most depressing conversation you ever had. But you sit down with somebody who cracks you up, they make you laugh. You're going to seek this person out again. Now, the second time you meet that person, then that person might start to reveal a little bit more that's more serious and still give you some laughs, and on it goes until you really get to know the person and you see the full range. But the person who makes you laugh, you're more likely to turn to. The only problem with this is, as one writer, Dave Duncan, pointed out, if you are funny, no one takes you seriously. And that is a potential threat, but some people get taken seriously anyway. And, you know, Mark Twain comes to mind, who was actually a superb human rights activist and was one of the main American writers exposing the Belgian Holocaust in Congo, which claimed about 10 million people. So, you know, you can be funny and you can be serious. So, yes?
Another question I'm surprised no one brought this up. How do you deal with writer's block?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I was searching for some kind of, you know, glib, cute response to that. But, I mean, it's a very serious issue. I would encourage everybody, if you feel blocked on a particular story, write something else. I don't mean start another book, because that could be a big mistake, and then you get into that one. And, not that anybody here has ever started a book that they had a tough time finishing. But but at any rate, but the thing is, write an article. You know, how many of you write for C or View? Man, what are you guys waiting for? You can get paid to write. You do. Okay, no, not for free. Get paid. Get paid. Write for pay. You know, I waited too long. I didn't switch. I still wrote an article with the Gateway when I was 25. I was like, as Chris Rock says, the old guy at the nightclub. You know, he's not really old. He's just old to be in the club. What am I going to the Gateway at 25 writing an article for them for? That's nuts. Write for pay today. Just go to See or View. Say, look, I already write here some articles. Can I write for you? They say, sure. That's all there is to it. Why give your writing away for free? You know? I mean, it's like, no, that's dirty. Don't say that. What are you doing? Are you crazy? Write for pay. That's what you want to do, right? You want to sell books. Pitch something to Alberta Views. There's lots of things across the country. You know, why not? Pitch it to I mean, I won't name local corporate papers, but I mean, Globe and Mail, whatever you like. Write for them. There's the Walrus. There's all kinds of this magazine. You know, write for pay. Legitimizes you right away. Whether you deserve it or not is a different question. That depends on you. But, you know, seriously. So, I don't even know. I got on this rant. What did you ask me? Oh, yeah, writer's block. Thank you. Go on a rant. See, there you go. Go on a rant. You'll get out of writer's block immediately. But, yeah, if you write an article, and it's great because another thing that I just cannot stress this enough, if you write, especially for, of the two papers, I've written for both, but I write for View more now. I switched over from C. You should write for whichever one you want, but C is mostly like a Gateway Plus. It's basically opinion pieces View requires you to do interviews, do investigations, be a real reporter. And some of the best writing comes out of people with a, not all of it, but with a journalistic background, because they've had to go out and meet so many people who aren't like them. They've had to transcribe dialogue or monologues. They've really learned through that. And so you go out and you do an article, suddenly you're looking at your manuscript, you're finished the first act, and you don't know how to go through that long middle passage. You do an article, you go, oh my gosh, there's this whole new way of looking at the world or a character or a problem, and suddenly you've got something that is honest and real. So for everybody, how many of you know David Simon, by any chance, the author of the book Homicide? Okay, good. Okay, right, of course, yes. So at any rate, Baltimore Sun reporter, spent a year with the Homicide Department in Baltimore so that he could learn what that life was like. Wrote the book Homicide. Can't stress it, the value of this highly enough. That led to the series Homicide. Now he writes a show called The Wire, which is perhaps the finest American police show there's ever been. And most of the writers on that show are former journalists. So if you write articles, you're going to gain immediately. Write poetry as well. By all means, write poetry. And do write scripts, but just do some writing. And if that doesn't work, do something fun. Don't believe the stuff that says, you got to suffer. You got to drink yourself into great writing. It's I don't see any evidence of that at all. Some of them who were drunks were good writers, but being drunks and dying of liver failure didn't make them good writers. And it actually cut their literary output when they died. Yes?
How do you handle plot and structure? Do you know where your story is going, or do they kind of write themselves?
Well, I do a lot of outlining. And Stephen King says that extensive outlining is the domain of the hack. And, I think that's nuts. And if outlining works for you, outline. Not everybody likes to do it. I do. I want to know where the book is going to end. If it turns out that I change my mind, I change my mind. But fine, How do you know if you got there unless you had an idea where you were going to go? So I recommend that. I certainly recommend for everybody. If you write in other forms, then you can apply the understandings that those forms have about writing and structure. Writing scripts, and I don't mean for stage, I mean writing for television. You don't have to work in television. You can just try learning that form. It forces you to understand plot. It forces you to understand, complications and so forth, and suspense. If your writing doesn't have people saying, and then what? I don't care how literary it is. If people never say, and then what? You're failing as a plotter. So you need, that is really important. I would suggest outlining and learning from scripts. Reading screenplays, you can get lots of free screenplays online. You can get them from various libraries. I think it's enormously helpful. I will say that when I had my first meeting with my then editor-to-be, I was in Manhattan and I had a meeting lined up for my agent, and I went down to the Ballantyne headquarters, and the editor had already read my first manuscript, which was to be published. I had written others before. And she said, "Oh, I love your language, but the plot!" She actually did that. She threw up her hands and she said, "But the plot!" It's not exactly what you want to hear from the person who's supposed to be changing your life with a contract. So, even if you get a book published, that doesn't mean that you're going to have a cookie cutter plot or anything like that. I mean, you can plot it the way that you want to. But does that answer your question? I don't know if that's giving you enough there. But I would really recommend it, and some people might think this is formulaic, but I think it's very helpful. Is figure out what your character's pain and misery is and his own flaws. That's the beginning. And then figure out how he or she triumphs over those problems, completely is crushed by them, or has a mix and match. And that's your story. How do you get there? That's your story. So that would be... Don, you should weigh in on this, because I'm curious about how you approach plotting. And you're working on a trilogy right now, so that's especially important.
I have to say I come at things a little bit differently. I generally don't work with outlines, because I found early on that when I started too soon with an outline, I got bored with it. The whole thing. It's like, okay, now I know what's going to happen. I don't feel like writing it. Because I realized I wanted to be the first reader of the book.
Right.
So it's a process of discovery, which means I end up as a writer with a lot of dead ends where I go, okay, no, these last five chapters or whatever, that's not going to work. And have to backtrack, right? So it means a lot of extra work, but yeah. It's the method that works for me. And you're absolutely right, though, that people have to find what's going to work for them. And
yes.
For some people, outlines are going to be really valuable.
Yeah.
For me, they are at a much later stage.
Yeah.
Where I want to stand back and I want to say, okay, I've got something going here, but it needs to be more structured now. It needs to go along more the lines of what you're talking about, you know, so that the reader is asking what's going to happen next and so on, right? At that later stage, I can use an outline to decide, okay, I don't really need this anymore. That can go. These parts have to be welded together. All those sorts of questions.
See, I give you real credit because not only is the proof is in the pudding, you've enjoyed enormous literary success and so forth, but during our creative writing class, I don't think anybody put as much effort into revision and rewriting as you did. And it takes a lot of guts because you are looking at stuff that you've done, and I mean, throwing out a chapter, oh, that is just one of the worst feelings, you know? It's like, because you want to edit, which means like, oh, word here, word there. It's like clipping your nails, and the doctor says, no, it's the whole arm, boy, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's a very different thing, right? Editing and revising, I think, are very different.
Mm.
Editing is kind of like the last stage when you've already got the book, and you're working on the surface, and you're fixing stuff, right?
Yeah.
Whereas revising, to me, is much more about going deeper into the book and seeing what it lacks or what it needs and what's working, all those sorts of things.
Yeah. Well, and whatever, you know, whatever the labels we put on it, yeah, certainly those two approaches are absolutely necessary. And it is scary. And I mean, some of you may have already experienced this, of like somebody reads your work and they, you know, they're supportive, they like what you do, but they say like, oh, I think your first five chapters, you know, really the book starts in chapter six. You say, but I only wrote five chapters. You know, but you know, if you got to cut it, you got to cut it. And some very fine books, you know, I've read, they're legends, you know, whether they're real or not, but you know, the writer turned his 800-page masterpiece into a 200-page bestseller, you know. So, you know, that's so. Those are tough things to deal with. I will say, you know, I definitely agree with you on the matter of writing. Not so much outlines for novels, because I myself, I'm so afraid of writing the chapter that I have to junk. That's why I want the security outline. But the scripts, what's standard, so I'm told in television, is that you submit a I can't remember what it's called, but it's sort of. It's basically you're writing, if a teleplay would be, let's say, about 45 to 50 pages long, you're writing the story, which is it broken down into five acts, and you're writing, you know, pieces of the dialogue and all of the description of what's happening. I wrote a couple of teleplays last summer, and the first one I didn't do that. And I loved writing because I wanted to find out what was happening. I just knew sort of barely where it was going. And that was a load of fun. The second one, I thought, I'm so slick. I'm so professional. I'm going to do the proper treatment. You know, if it's a treatment, I'm going to do all that. And it was hell returning to the keyboard because I knew exactly what was going to happen. And there it was just like, you know, it's like, I don't know, if you were Michelangelo, I'm not saying I'm comparing myself to Michelangelo, but if you were thinking that you're Michelangelo and somebody, you know, gave you a paint by numbers, it's like, well, you know, what do I need this for? So don't repeat to somebody that I was comparing myself to Michelangelo. I was just making a point, right? Saw a couple of people go, oh, I can't believe it. All right, so any other questions about the business? Or yes?
Do you know who your audience is going to be, or do you write for a certain audience, or do you get surprised when certain people read the books?
Yeah, you know, that's a really interesting question. I guess, again, you know, attempted to say something glib, but really, you know, I never know. And what was really interesting for me was that with this particular book, the book deals with a range of issues, psychotherapy, feminism in different stages of feminism and waves, with racial injustice and economic injustice in media. And I found that there was, and I don't want to say too much on this subject, but there was a cultural divide in terms of how people related to one of the characters. So, you know, I'm probably being too obvious. Basically, people from one group thought this one character was bad. People from another group thought this character was good. So, you know, that was quite a shock. And I thought, at first I thought like saying, hey, you're wrong, you read my book wrong. And then I thought, well, this is actually kind of neat. I mean, it's really interesting to see people react so differently to the same words. And if I was the only one and everybody else said, wow, that guy's an asshole, and I'm the only guy saying, oh, but he's nice, then I'd think I had really screwed up. But if it divides like that, then the book becomes a kind of a weird sociological experiment. And that's kind of fun. So, you know, you just never know who's going to read it. You'll have people who you think are going to hate your work, and they'll love it, and people who you're sure would love your work, and they'll hate it. But I believe that, you know, I'm satisfied if everybody hates the work, so long as they buy multiple copies of it. So, yes?
Why published under the name Minister Faust instead of your real name?
Sure.
Is that a decision that's up to you or your publisher?
It's up to me. I mean, I had been doing stuff under pseudonyms since high school. And the thing about a pseudonym is that it's about mystique. And that is fun, you know? Like, I'm sure everybody in this room has gone to some kind of costume party or Halloween gig. It's fun to put on a costume. And it's fun to put on voices. And it's fun to have make-believe and pretend, which is all writing is. You know? It's all make-believe. So even the stuff that's supposed to be true, you know? So a pseudonym gives you that opportunity to have people say, oh, what's this? I mean, it depends on the pseudonym. If you call yourself, you know, Larry, you know, Smith, that's not going to, there's not a lot of mystique in that. But, you know, it can create interest. And, you know, there's a proud tradition of pseudonyms, you know, and so I figured why not. And, I've read some web comments from a few people who say, what pretentiousness, I can't believe someone would say there's a minister about, you know. But other people who write to me and say, like, wow, man, you're so cool, you know, that's kind of nice to get an email like that. Somebody says, well, a name like that, that's got to be good. I mean, it's not a very critical statement, but I'll take it, you know. So, yeah. So.
Does it help you to get into the sort of writing zone or something? Do you feel like, okay, now I'm Mr. Faust, right? Does it work?
Interesting. Well, I don't know, you know? I mean, because when in your own head, you're just always you. And even when you're putting on a persona, because, you know, you talk differently with your parents than you do with your partner or with your buddies or, you know, what are kids you meet in the street. So you're always, in one sense, in a persona, but in your head, it's just authentically you at that moment. You know, when it comes to getting into the headspace, I'd like to say that there's a certain acclaimed writer in this room who appeared on the cover of the journal surrounded by candles and a skull, if I recall, who said that he'd written his entire book on a manual typewriter surrounded by... And I looked at that and I said, no, man, he did not do that, you know. But it made for a great cover story and, you know, I'm sure sold a lot of books, you know. So really, I mean, that is... You can be whatever you're... I don't really believe in talent. I believe in skill and hard work and effort and all that kind of stuff and revision. Whatever that quality of your craft is, that's one thing. And then they're selling books. And, you know, did you have another one of those shticks? Like, because I seem to recall you had another one that was really, really clever.
Sure.
Okay, I don't.
Something I want to forget about.
Okay, well, I won't bring up any more of these little scandals. But yeah, I mean, it's fun and really, you know, Robert Sawyer you know, some of you have paper. Whether your plan is to write science fiction or fantasy or to write whatever, go to sfwriter.com. Robert Sawyer's blog, which has got or his webpage, which is something like 1 million words of text on it, all for free to the public, is packed with advice on what you as a writer who doesn't have anything published or does have your first book published or are worried because your third book looks like it's going to be your last. He's got all kinds of advice. SFWriter.com is an amazing resource. And one of the things he says is, you know, get involved be a subject for local media. If you have been doing some journalism, you'll know a bunch of subjects. You will already have contacts in local media. Do stuff for campus radio because it's free training ground. Then do some stuff freelance for CBC. Get into various areas where you'll get known because it's a lot easier to get coverage for your books if people know you and ideally if they like you than if they don't know you and potentially dislike you, you know. So do those things. That is part of it, you know. And I'll just share a very sad, it's funny, but it's a sad story. The publicity director at Del Rey, which is the subdivision of Ballantyne Random House that publishes this book, and my other, was brilliant at PR. And she told me, you know, she liked working with me because I had public speaking experience, and that was easy for her she didn't have to do as much work on presenting me, you know. But she said with some writers, because of course to be a writer requires a lot of solitary time, and it appeals to a lot of people who are very shy, and people who've maybe been kicked around by life, and she said she had to tell to tell some writers to wash before they're, before they went out to meet people. And, you know, like, it's it, you're like, yeah, you're, I mean, I laughed too when I first heard it, and then I went, oh, that's so sad, you know? So I'm not suggesting anything about you, and that's not a hint, okay? But it does mean that, like, public speaking, for instance, is something that everybody can learn, and even if it scares the hell out of you. And, like, I got the advice, you know, I heard people, writers being given the advice, oh, never do accents, never speak in dialect, never, you know, read, you know, expressively. Why not? You're reading. It's a show. You know, it's not scones with the queen. So, you know, have fun. Have a hoot, you know.
Make sure you practice before you
try. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, don't suck. You know, like, you know, learn, train, you know. It's some ways like being a stand-up comic. You got to test material out before smaller groups, see what's working, and, you know, that's a lot of fun. I would, you know, if you're writing something that's really bleak and serious, it is tough to read that before an audience. You can sometimes do it. What I would suggest in those cases is find something that you've read that has been funny, get them hooked, and then go on with something sad. And I was at the Roar last year, and I read something that was funny from one book, and then I read something from an unpublished manuscript that was really probably the single saddest thing I've ever written. And it got a great response. I was really scared as hell to do that, because I thought, well, I was a very vulnerable piece, and it went over great. So, you know, you can get those skills, you can practice, you can learn all that stuff. But, you know, really, like, this is fun. Almost none of us is ever going to get rich from the writing. So you might as well get everything else you can out of it, like having fun and meeting neat people and hopefully saying something that you really care about and should stand the test of time. So, but, yeah, readings. I mean, what do you like best about doing readings?
Actually, I like talking to people afterwards. And when I started out, I was very, very shy and nervous, and I didn't think I thought that would be the scariest part, right? Because I thought, you know, I don't want to be put on the spot or whatever. But it turned out that it's great to just communicate with people, put the book down. And,
Yeah, it's true. And, you know, and to listen to them at that point and to say, like, not like this is Q&A or Q and speech or Q and rant, but afterwards it's, so really, so you write. Well, tell me about what you write. And then you get to shut up and listen to folks, and, you know, there's some great things and really powerful, beautifully worded things that you can immediately write down and put into your next book before they can publish them. So, I was kidding for those of you who are grimacing. So at any rate, time is really, it's already 4:30. Is this the shutting up time? I don't want
to. We don't have a real end time, unless people want to end. Do you have somewhere to go right away?
I mean, I'll happily take more questions, but I don't want to make people feel guilty and like, I want to leave 20 minutes ago. You know, so you know, if you want, I'll happily stay if you want to stay, but I don't want you to feel trapped. So it's nice to meet you, and I'll stick around if anybody wants to talk one-on-one, and thanks very much for having me. I appreciate it.